on CommanderCast.com. If you're listening to this, it's an off week for Noel and Aaron, but it's an on week for Aaron and Aaron. Welcome to the stat. So hopefully you're going to listen to this and not just say, oh, it's not Rival Fuel Week, and listen to us. We are the Sorcery Slow podcast for all your weird and delayed news. We record things way ahead of schedule because Eric is on top of things. I am really slow at getting to everything else. And, it's just kind of how it rolls. So with me is Eric, a.k.a. Grandpa Growth. How you doing, Gramps?
I'm doing pretty good. We got some interesting things to talk about this evening. So
yeah,
I'm excited.
Yeah, the content for this episode is going to be a little bit different. As usual, we're indirectly talking about magic again. And this week, we're going to be really indirectly talking about magic because we're just going to do some non-interview or non-magic related interview questions, just kind of shooting the shit and just seeing what the other person thinks. And we haven't even talked about these questions before the show. We just said that we were going to do this. So should be pretty exciting, should be pretty fun. But first, we do have some really cool and fascinating magic news, something that I didn't even really notice, and Gramps actually brought it to my attention. So you want to go ahead and lead with that?
Yeah. So at the Battle for Zendikar pre-releases, or no, this was not Battle for Zendikar. This was it Magic Origins pre-releases? Yeah, it was Magic Origins pre-release. There was a blind player. This was featured on Imgur as the first place I saw it. But the story came out of Lancaster, England, and at the Magic Origins pre-release, a blind Magic the Gathering player, MTG fan, was playing in the pre-release, and they documented photos and, just sort of like the story took off virally. The way that he does this is that he has a special typewriter that allows him to sort of print Braille onto card sleeves. And he's done, just a huge amount of work up front. So he's got basically all the cards in the set memorized, and he had his friend there helping him out to like sort through his card pool and tell him what he has. Then while he's, deciding what's going to be played in his deck, he's typing up what all the cards do into his typewriter that prints Braille onto the sleeves, and that's what he uses to play with. So like when he has cards in play, he can just sort of feel on his battlefield, like, these are the lands I have, these are the cards that I have in play, here's the cards in my hand, and he can actually read them just like we would with normal vision. And I thought this is awesome. The triumph of the human spirit. Nobody can tell you no except yourself. If you want it, you can get it done.
Yeah, this is probably one of the coolest stories I think I've seen in a very long time about magic. There's a lot of really great stories about things that Magic's trying to do to make sure that the accessibility of the game, that it's universally accessible, that nobody, you can't do anything, there's nothing that, should be in your way in order to be able to set up and be able to do things. I think one of the couple of cool points about this, I think that they mentioned that he actually gets a little bit of a head start. He gets like an extra hour or something to help go through his pool and build his deck and stuff. So they actually allowed him an extra hour. But other than that, I think most of everything else was, he did a lot of legwork beforehand, like you mentioned, but it's not something that anybody else wouldn't do as a regular Magic player, right? Like, you have to, if you want to be good at the game, you have to memorize the cards. You have to do these things. So it wouldn't surprise me any bit if he, won quite a few games because he's got a good knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was given, he had the same 45 minutes to evaluate his card pool and build his deck that everyone else did. But he was allowed 2 hours beforehand to type up sleeves. Obviously that process is not instantaneous. I don't even know really how it goes. There's some pictures that show you sort of what it looks like, but still, I can't really imagine the amount of work that goes into that. But, in terms of considering what is going to be in his pool and actually building his deck, he was on the same time constraints that everyone else was, which is crazy, But obviously, knowing what cards are available and being able to, just decide mentally, you have to keep that all in your head. You can't see it. You don't have anything like, the cards themselves don't have Braille printed on them, so he can't just, group them together and, think about a particular subset of his pool without actually sleeving those cards up. It's just really tough, and it's really cool to see him overcome that. I forgot to mention this in the beginning, but the player's name is Richard, and the tournament organizer who shared the story, her name was Imogen. Yep. And if you want to see the original post on Imgur, her name is Saltrox, Saltrox on Imgur.
Yeah, we'll leave.
But it made it to the front page, and so it became a pretty big story in the internet. community, at least.
Yeah, we'll be leaving the image in the image gallery in the show notes so that you guys can see it, because it's really incredible. You know, I didn't even know that this is the way that a blind Magic player would have to play, that they would have to have these kinds of sleeves with Braille on them. And one of the cool things that's one of the cool details to me that was in the slideshow, I guess is the best way to describe it, was that they mentioned that on cards that have less, you know, words and less power information, that he actually double types that, which seems, you know, in order to balance the card out so that his opponents can't tell what it is. I guess if he's playing another blind Magic player, maybe they accidentally bump into the table and they feel out his cards. I don't really know, but it was just a cool story. You know, that's got to be expensive too. I mean, to be able to have to buy, you know, sleeves every time. I mean, I can't. Do you think that they're custom sleeves? Like, what would he be? You know, is it just straight up Ultra Pros? Like,
yeah, he's actually. You can see in the photos, he's just playing with Ultra Pros texture back sleeves, which is, I mean, my preferred type of sleeve.
Yeah,
I don't know how the fans feel about that, but
no one likes
them. Is it expensive? Yeah, I guess it's a little bit more expensive, but like. It's probably an extra like $5 to $10 every time he wants to play in a pre-release event like this. But as far as his normal like casual play goes, it wouldn't be nearly as bad. You know, if you've got your regular collection of cards and you want to play Commander, he could just type out one sleeve. You know, I don't think that he plays Commander, but the point I'm getting at is with Constructed, it'd be a little bit less of an issue. I think the major expense really is having this special machine and carrying it around with them and getting to the tournament site. I've never been blind, but I've been told that getting around is not necessarily easy or convenient. You know, it really depends on the city that you're in and how amenable they are and, you know, how robust the transportation system is, how robust your network of people that can support you is, which is true whether you're blind or not, let's be honest.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, great story. Unfortunately, The one thing I want to know, which actually was not covered in the imager gallery, they didn't share how he did at the pre-release, which, you know, I want him to win. I wanted this story to cap off with, and he obliterated everyone. He's the best. You'll see him on the pro tour.
Yeah.
But sadly, nothing like that. Just, he was a guy at the pre-release, and that's the end of the story.
Well, I thought it was weird that they mentioned in this thing that he, that people had to announce all their stuff and that they felt uncomfortable about it. Like, this is what we do all the time, you know? Like, I feel like as a Magic player, it's our duty to be communicative in that way. And there's like, you know, there's somebody at my shop and I went, I was like, okay, I'm playing a mountain. Okay, go. And like, he was like, you need to announce your stuff. I'm like, well, I just did. And then he was, you know, there were points in the game where he was like, you know, I play with my ears, and I was like, okay. And like, then he wasn't listening. Like, I don't quite get some of this like kind of mixed message, but going back to being a blind person and playing Magic, like, I just don't understand how anybody couldn't be communicative with the game.
Well, you know, a lot of what you're communicating in Magic normally can be done with gestures. You're like, I can point at cards to indicate targets. I don't necessarily even know the names of all the cards that are in my deck sometimes. You know, like, I'll know what Foff does, but, like, some of the times I'll just be like, I know the text box on this card, but I don't remember what it does. And I played it 10 minutes ago, and I just don't pay attention to the sort of details like that. But in his situation, you know, you have to be very clear that this is what's on the stack, you know, and then this other effect is on top of it. And you can't just be pointing at things. Like, you have to be giving him very clear, audible instructions. You know, his hearing is fine, and obviously he's an intelligent young gentleman, and he can speak just fine. So telling him that, you know, like, I tap my three mountains to cast this spell, and, like, I'm targeting your whatever creature that's in play, you know, then he'll go, look, okay, like, here, yeah, that's actually the card you said it was, and, like, here's this thing. But he sort of needs an independent arbiter to really, like, I guess, administrate the game, because everyone else's sleeves aren't printed in Braille. So I could just always say that I drew Black Lotus off the top, you know, and, like, you know, if people wanted to be scummy about it, there's definitely potential there, but, like, you'd really have to be some type of rude ass. Like, you're really asking for treatment in the afterlife.
Yeah. No, speaking of, you know, just game accessibility, like, it's there in terms of that, there is a guy, a couple of people actually that come into the shop that I'm playing at now at Card Kingdom. It's a really sweet shop. I would say it's far superior to most game shops I've ever been in, because it's just regularly streamed Magic players. There were 47 people that played Legacy the other night. Just an example. Anyway, which just seems insane, right? I mean, that's not a small number. anyway, there was a guy in there playing Legacy, and he was, you know, in a wheelchair, and he actually had an assistant with him that was holding his cards, and he was making all the decisions, but, you know, she was there to specifically help him play Magic. And I just thought that was really cool.
Yeah. You know, I think the main takeaway for me in regards to this story was that, like, we talk a lot about making the game more friendly and more accessible and growing the player base for a variety of reasons. You know, it's one part social justice, one part business, one part community, and one part just like good old fashioned fun. Like, we want to have more people to play against, and we think the game is great and want to share it with other people. But usually the stories you hear about bringing new players into the game or people struggling in an early part of playing the game, they don't put too fine a point on it like this does. Like, yeah, he's really committed. I don't know how long he's been playing, but I'm sure that getting into the game was not easy. And, you know, he exerts a lot of effort to continue playing, because I don't even want to leave my house, and everything about my body works. You know, like, I sometimes just want to be with my couch.
I totally understand.
But, you know, he's getting up, he's coming out to tournaments, he's playing in his local store and being, you know, an active participant in his local community. And, you know, that's just great. I think that he's a model citizen of the game. And, you know, whether he wants it or not, he's about to become this, like, de facto ambassador story that people are going to share. Like, you know, it's, you can do it too. Like, other people who have, you know, any type of disability can still play the game. It's a safe space. It's an accessible space, and it's a fun thing to do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that you're hitting on a question that I was asking myself actually a few moments ago when we were talking. How does a blind person get involved in Magic? Like, that, you know, not that there's anything wrong with this at all, but, like, you know, what's appealing? Like, what, you know, how does that happen? You know, I'm fascinated by this question.
Well, they didn't go into it. I would guess that he maybe has been playing for a long time and, like, lost his sight in the intervening period. That's total speculation on my part.
Yeah.
But also, I'm not capable of imagining human beings with, like, the beautiful complexity they, you know, encompass themselves. He can appreciate a fun strategy game just like anyone else, regardless of, you know, his eyesight. So, like, if I think that this game is great, and if someone showed me this game and I wanted to start playing it more, like, what?
Nothing
to
stop
me.
You.
It's, yeah, like, what's the difference for him? Just because he's blind? Oh, well, like, clearly he solved that problem. You know,
I'm just
he's
talking
made it
about,
a non-issue.
I'm just talking about, like, the exposure to this. Like, you know, like, I guess for me, like, one of the appeals is that there's a lot of great art in this game. And so, like, I think a lot of players get hooked because of story, because of art. And I would just be fascinated by the idea of this guy, you know, he walks into a card shop and he's like, you know, I don't know, what does he say? What does he do? You know, hey, I want to play a game. I mean, obviously, you know, he's interested in games. I think that your point of him, you know, maybe he played it and loved it before he lost his sight and he had to rehab and work his way back into playing Magic, which seems completely logical. But, you know, I guess the circle of interests, I'm trying to say, like, in terms of, like, games and things that are more accessible for blind people, it seems like it would be different. So it's just fascinating to me, just to know to want to know the story. It's compelling, you know?
Yeah. Well, first, the art is done very well, and it's by great artists, but mm-hmm. I stand by that cards shouldn't have names or art. Bring your pitchforks in the comments. But, you know, more seriously, like, I don't think it's weird that he could just show up and be like, hey, you know what? I'm competitive. I'm smart. And I walk into a hobby gaming store and just be like, hey, guys, you know, you all like something about this. Show me. Like, show me what's cool. Show me something I can get into. That's just as plausible to me as him liking the game before he became blind. Because, you know what? I get bored all the time. Like, sometimes I'm doing stuff in my life and I'm just, you know what? I need something new. I feel like everyone should be comfortable enough jumping outside of their personal limitations, regardless of what they are. You know, it might be physical, it might be mental, it might be emotional, but, you know, you just got to do some new stuff. And if you find out you like new things, why not dive in head first? Bring your Braille typewriter and beat face with his Llanowar Impath. And he's got a Dwinen, I believe, in one of these pictures. So
he's going green.
Yeah. Black green elves in Origins sealed deck. I can get behind that. It
Sounds
is a
like
legit
doing
strat.
It, doing it. So, yeah. All right. Well, that wraps up nicely, I think, with, you know, probably the coolest social justice story I think we've seen in Magic.
This is not a social justice story.
Okay. Well, we don't have to call it that.
Yeah. Coolest community story.
Yeah. Coolest community story. Whatever. You said you used the word social justice. I was repeating it for journalism's sake, and then I got, you know, told no. It sounds like a game of Commander we used to play.
Listen, this is an important lesson for everyone out there. Don't do what Grandpa does. You can't trust me.
Yeah. That was very, very sneaky. All right. So we're gonna shift gears here, and we're gonna get off magic topics and start talking about just some things that, you know, some non-magic related interview questions that we wanted to ask each other. So I'll let Gramps go first because he's the one who brought this topic up, and I think it'd be super sweet.
Yeah. Well, it was getting down to the wire, and we didn't have a lot to talk about for today's show, and I've been thinking in my head that you get to hear the personality and the interaction on Commander Cast Prime. Like, those guys have been working together for a long time. We've been listening to them for a while, and you just get to see a lot more of the personality that they have in their show. And now that we're doing a podcast, sort of, you know, trading on their name, not to put too fine a point on it, but maybe it's time we got some of our own personality injected into this. So we're going to ask each other some questions. Hopefully we get some funny and interesting answers that will give you a little better insight into who we are as people. Maybe not necessarily as Magic players so much, but it's going to go somewhere interesting. I can guarantee that.
Yep.
The first question that I have for you is, what are you drinking?
What am I drinking? So, history lesson for everybody. When I first started, when Eric and I first started hanging out in the lounge at Smith Hall, playing Magic and Pokemon and all kinds of stuff all the time in college, I basically would just come down with like whatever drink I could find and just start, you know, sit there probably for 4 or 5 hours, maybe even longer than that, hang out, do homework maybe, but mostly play Magic. And I always had a gigantic ass drink because I refused to buy like small, like reasonably sized Gatorades. So I would always have something that was at least a liter, maybe 2 liters. And so I'd have anything from like Canada Dry green tea ginger ale to like citrus tea, Lipton citrus green tea. And I just have like the whole thing. And I would sit there and I would have that. And I would, it was basically the big drink, if you will.
Big drink was like his key item of choice. It was like, you know, sometimes you just have people and they can't be found without their X, Y, or Z. His thing was big drink.
Yeah.
And when he said that 1 liter was an option, 1 liter was not an option.
Yeah.
Like, so, it was very often a gallon of green tea.
It was a whole lot. It was a whole lot of tea. So currently right now, I actually have a bottle of what's a very interesting mixture of Mio water-infused beverages. It's actually Arnie Palmy. From the Mio little thing. And I think it's also a Tropical Fusion Mio Energy. So it's those mixed in water. I'm actually on a, and it's a liter, actually. It's actually a liter this time. So I have gone down in size, but I do have 4 other liter bottles sitting in my fridge right now getting cold. And I've been through 3 of them today. So drinking a lot of fluid to keep myself hydrated. You know, that's how I do. What are you drinking right now?
You're just going to turn it straight back on me?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm drinking Pinot Noir, which is a red wine for those who are not up on that, and neither was I until about 5 days ago. I drink a ton of beer, as Aaron knows.
Yes.
However, I have recently been informed that beer like has as much sugar, and you know, like this follows very naturally. I know beer has a ton of calories. I'm not like retarded, but I'm reevaluating my diet somewhat and like cutting down on my beer intake because beer has so much sugar and so many calories. Like, that is a very easy place that I can eliminate calories. Whereas certain varieties of red wine have a lot fewer calories per ounce and a lot less sugar. Obviously, they don't taste as good to me. But, you know, I'm doing what I can so I don't get the diabetes. And I'm hooking up red wine, yeah.
Yeah.
I cannot tell you which brand it is, but I can tell you I got it in the like regular aisle at my grocery store. It is not fancy.
Avoiding the Wilford Brimley-ness.
yeah.
Seems like a good thing. I mean, also, red wine's supposed to have some kind of health benefit, I think, like long term. You know, like not just the diabetes, but
yeah, it's been associated with better cardiac outcomes, but
yeah.
I don't think that that's really gonna come to bear on me too much. Like, won't we all be robots at that point anyway?
Well,
I hope so.
If you follow Sheldon Minnery on Twitter or just his wine blog, you could be more informed about your wine choices for henceforth.
Oh, wow. Well, I actually do not follow Sheldon Minnery on Twitter or just about anything else he does.
Yeah.
But now maybe I can have a reason to. Maybe he'll actually say something I agree with for once.
Yeah, so you guys could be wino buddies or whatever.
Yeah, the vino! Okay. Okay.
All right, so my first question is, I want to say maybe 6 months ago or something, back when we were on the General Zone at least, so it was really early this year, maybe January, February, we had an episode of The Stack back in its original form, which was just a card and some comments, and I made comments about Firefly, and Eric said that he watched it and hated it. And I have to know why you hate the Firefly.
You're going to do this to me on the internet?
Oh, yeah.
You know that I'm going to be crucified.
I know. And I'm putting you on the spot, and you have to tell me and explain to me why. I just don't know this person, and I want to know the Firefly hater. So.
Yeah, okay. I don't like science fiction in general.
Okay.
So we're going to lay that statement down, and we're going to immediately set it aside. I know like that is a crime in and of itself to some people. My main thing is, like, good sci-fi is itself it's a poignant critique about society. Bad sci-fi is just nonsense, pure garbage. As with any bad form, you know, like, there's good and bad everything. The bad is usually really bad. The good stuff is what you want to talk about. There is definitely good sci-fi, but I'm usually not a fan of the genre. Because that line, they have to toe this line between current social commentary and fancy gimmicks, essentially. Like, oh, look at these visual effects, or look at this Deus Ex Machina treatment. You know, I tend to not be into it. Firefly is particularly egregious to me because it totally falls flat on the social commentary thing for me. It didn't say anything about my current society that I gave two craps about. It had a bunch of people in the cast and production that I'm not very big fans of. I'm actually a huge Joss Whedon hater, which is going to be like the second of five things that people will want to crucify me for about this. I don't like anything he's ever done. So
even the Avengers movie?
That's tough. I am not a big fan of the Avengers movies, no.
Okay.
But that's a perfect example of like what's bad about it. It's like he's very good at making something that is interesting and entertaining to the audience and sort of sweeping over plot holes or like characters acting in ways that I feel like are inconsistent with their character. To use the actual term, this is bad characterization. But that sort of breaks up my immersion, and in sci-fi, immersion is crucial. This is not like a current age, modern day character drama where everything is realistic. In sci-fi, we have these, you know, moments where we lilt back and forth between reality, and like you have to accept certain assumptions, like we're in a spaceship or we're traveling all over the verse, you know.
It's just, the verse.
It just breaks my immersion so bad. But like, so many things are not correct about your ship scientifically, I can tell you right now. Like, I don't know. I have a tough time putting all my thoughts. This could be a 3-day conversation. Okay. And everyone that I've ever spoken to thinks that Firefly is great and thinks that I'm a total shitbag. And I just have accepted that I'm a shitbag. So,
well,
I refuse to admit that I'm wrong, but like,
no,
I've never heard any good reasons to sort of counteract that. If someone presented me a good argument about why it's great, I would be open to hearing it.
Okay. So I'm not going to present you, I'm not going to tell you anything that you don't want to think. I think that you present a reasonable argument. My assessment of the show is completely different. Like, I don't look at it as a science fiction show. I think that one of the things about the show is that, yes, it takes place in the future, but it's just a story about characters in the future, dealing with something that he created. Like, it's just a world. It wasn't to me, and I think that that's what's cool about it versus other science fiction things. I'm not a big fan, like, and this is going to get people to hate me, but, like, you know, I think the Star Wars euphoria is kind of overblown, in my opinion. Not that it isn't good, but just that people think it's, like, the greatest. I just completely disagree in terms of sci-fi. In fact, I think you and I would both agree that Interstellar just beats the pants off of most sci-fi things that have come out in the last...
Sure, yeah.
You know, like, Interstellar is fantastic. I also really enjoyed Moon, the Sam Rockwell and Kevin Spacey movie. I think that those both are really good, like, cool sci-fi, in the ways that sci-fi is meant to be. Kurt Vonnegut, obviously, I like his style of sci-fi. That is direct social commentary and satire and all the cool things that you want in a Kurt Vonnegut style world. But in terms of just general media, but as far as Firefly goes, I don't think that it's in the class of any of those things. I think it's just character driven stuff that just happens. And I think it's more Western-y than it is really, or Wild Wild West, than it is science fiction.
Yeah, it is. Well, he did that. Joss Whedon is the he in the sense. Did that intentionally. He's like, oh, look, I'm playing around with multiple genres, and how are you going to characterize me? He loves to do this kind of garbage, and it just makes it feel more gimmicky to me. Mm-hmm. And you hit it on the head that this is the point where I disagree most strongly with everyone's assessment of Firefly. People who like it say that it's really this show about these interesting characters, and you can leave all the sci-fi stuff aside because they could just as easily be riding horses instead of hover bikes or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, to me, none of the characters are interesting. It's not particularly well made or well acted. It's much like early Superman comics, where like the character is garbage, the writing is pretty much garbage, the production value was low, even compared to other TV syndicated, you know, I guess comparables at the time. And
2001.
I don't understand why it gets such a huge cult following. You know, but who am I? You know.
I liked the characters. I have no issues with them. I get it. I just, you know, I was just wondering why. I mean, I figured you're a person who, when they don't like something, they have good reasons. And I can't tell you that Joss Whedon hasn't done some real bad things to shows. So, you know, I'm not going to tell you he's great. I think that he has a decent sensibility with some things, but I think he doesn't know how to where to go when he's taken it too far. And the Avengers, I think, is like one of the best examples. I think that I watched the movies. I didn't pay for them, so I feel vindicated in that. And that's all I have to say about Joss Whedon. So we can move on to our next question if you don't have anything else.
Yeah, I think that we agree that if Kurt Vonnegut had written Firefly, it would be a better show.
Yeah, KurtVonnegutRules.com. If you guys also like Kurt Vonnegut, you should show your support in the comments below.
Yeah, he's the real deal. Joss Whedon is the old and busted.
All right.
My next question is, what is the closest CD, like physical CD, and we're talking music here, not like software.
Yeah.
What's the closest CD to you right now? And if you don't have one, like in your apartment or within sight, what's the last one you actually played? What's the last album you played?
Actually, it was, I don't have any CDs anymore because I left them at home. And if,
well,
I
that's,
had, yeah.
That's at the heart of the question. Like, not what's the last music you listened to or what's music you like. What is the last physical CD you played?
The last physical CD. So I think it might have been the last Incubus album that came out. No, not the EP, but the one before it.
If Not Now, When?
Yeah, If Not Now, When. That's probably the last one I played. The last album I listened to, though, was this morning, and it was the Foo Fighters' Sonic Highways, which I've really enjoyed. I know how you feel about the Foo Fighters. I think that this album is probably their like pinnacle work. They're finally creating a sound that sounds like Dave and the Foo Fighters and not like Nirvana or, you know, other bands. And they're inspired by these other bands, but they're inspired in a good way. So I really liked it.
Okay.
Have you heard about the HBO documentary that they did and the concept of Sonic Highways?
I have not.
Okay.
As you alluded to, not a massive fan. I'm much warmer on Foo Fighters than I am on Joss Whedon, but not exactly red hot, you might say.
Yeah. So the last album that they just put out, I think it was early this year or late last year, it's called Sonic Highways. And the concept was that they went and they recorded in studios all across America for like 2 weeks or so. And in the meantime, in between them, Dave found people from the museum who had roots in those areas and interviewed them about their music and about the history of the music. And he tried to pick either old studios that had a lot of great history or new up and coming places with, you know, musicians that are kind of on the up. You know, for example, in Nashville, he recorded with Zac Brown Band Studio, which, you know, is country music, but it's probably the more old. It's definitely got like a classic inspirational roots versus some of the more modern country. Anyway. So he did a lot of interviewing, did a lot of stuff, and it's all in the HBO documentary. And what he did before the album was they released these episodes on HBO. There's like 8 or 9 of them. And he went through, I think there's 8 songs in the album, so it's 8 songs. And he went through and they talked about all the history and they did the documentary part. And at the end, they released the song. And there's a lot of really cool stories. And anyway, I think it helps you to enhance the experience of his music because it's understanding the meaning behind the lyrics and behind the songs. And I've been listening to it pretty much repeatedly the last couple of days. And I have to say, like, it enhanced a lot of the song, or it enhanced like over half the album for me experience, but some of the other songs weren't as good. So the one that they're playing on the radio is super sweet, though. Something from Nothing. there's a lot of cool stories with that. So I highly encourage you guys to check it out if you guys haven't already.
I have actually heard this song.
Okay.
I normally listen to only NPR, but through a weird conflux of circumstances, I've heard this song.
Yeah.
That's the only reason I know that they've released a new album.
Yeah. Something from Nothing is a really cool one. It's their first song on the album, so it's the first episode of the Sonic Highways thing, and it's takes place in Chicago, the city that he wrote about. If you don't get that from the second line, "Here lies a city on fire," then you might not, you know, you might not live in America. Or
which
no history.
Totally possible.
Yeah, which is totally possible and totally fine, but that's where it comes from. And there's some other lines in the lyrics that are pretty sweet. He makes a couple of allusions to some things that Buddy Guy and Muddy Water did, because they're the people who founded like Chicago blues. Mm-hmm. And there, you know, there's you know, a button on a string, because apparently the two of them, you know, they were so poor they didn't really have musical instruments, so they're like tying button strings and buttons together to make instruments to pluck. And there's another, I think it's, I can't remember who says it, if it's Muddy Waters or Buddy Guy, but, you know, when they got to Chicago, they said that they were looking for a dime and they found a quarter, and that's part of the lyrics of his song. I think it's just really cool, you know, even if it's not his own words, it feels pretty sincere and, you know, understanding where they come from, and that connects him to their music. And I just thought it was a super sweet song in that regard.
Yeah. Muddy Waters is kind of what's up.
Yeah.
For those. I mean, if you're not in a blues, oh well, like yeah. that's your loss as far as I'm concerned, but. If you are, you know who he is, and you know he is, in fact, pretty sweet. And also, I wanted to mention that it's cool to me that they recorded at least part of this album in Nashville, because I'm not a big country fan, but I've been getting turned on more and more to groups that are working and playing in that area. And there's a lot of music getting made that is not roots music. It's not, you know, country. It's not blues. It's, you know, like new stuff, stuff you wouldn't associate with the Nashville like music heritage,
so,
which is interesting.
Two comments I wanted to make on that. One of the things is that, you know, definitely I can attest to that. I have two friends that are up there right now, and one of them has a studio in his house, and he's, you know, starting to do some of that stuff. Another guy is a studio musician, and he's working through some of that stuff as well. Other comment I wanted to make is something that's really cool about Nashville that's different than the other things that I saw, especially in the going back to this Sonic Highways thing. One of the interesting things about Nashville is that it has a history of creating this dichotomy between singer and songwriter. So, like, a lot of the times, the best songs were written by people that weren't even songwriters. And it's a huge history. If you know anything about Johnny Cash and Willie Nelson and, you know, people like Kris Kristofferson, who was a famous actor, but he got his start writing songs for these people in Nashville on records. The way that, and, you know, even Dolly Parton and all these people, like, a lot of times they were just the performers. They were the face to the song. And these other people were writing the music. And Nashville is kind of like the match.com, if you will, for all of this kind of stuff. So just a really cool, different dynamic than you see in any other part of the country.
Yeah, this process actually is detailed in a book called The Song Machine by John Seabrook. And it covers that, and also how that got shifted from, you know, the 50s and 60s up to today, and how it's really like the same syndicate, the same cabal of people who make music are still creating those top 10 hits. And it's weird that they're middle-aged and older Norwegian people, and like stuff, you know, it's not Miley Cyrus who writes Miley Cyrus songs. It's often other people. And there, as you said, is and always has been a big dichotomy of singer and songwriter. And that's weird to say. I think if you showed most people, like, do you feel your artists are genuine, and like they'd be like, yeah, but then you show them, okay, well, here's their 10 biggest songs, and they wrote exactly zero of them, how genuine do you feel about, you know, the music industry and the people who make your favorite music? That would really shock some people, if I feel like, if you showed them that information.
It's really interesting to me that it worked for some of them, in my opinion, like on me, you know, I've had an effect, but it didn't change my opinion about some of the better bands. Like the better ones, you know, I'm just like, okay, great. Like Led Zeppelin, you know, like this is one of the biggest ones where, you know, people are like, you know, the biggest criticism of them is that they didn't write all of their music. In fact, most of their hits, they didn't even write, and that they were all ripoffs of other people. And, you know, to me, like, that doesn't even matter. Like, it doesn't matter. But, you know, for example, if it's, I can't think of anybody off the top of my head right now, but, you know, if I were to find out that, you know, somebody else wrote a song, I probably wouldn't give a crap. You know, I think Nickelback, like, I'm looking at Nickelback, they don't write a lot of their music, they get music sent to them and things like that, and I'm just like, oh, yep, you know, everybody's saying the same thing about them, so.
Yeah, if you don't think that When the Levee Breaks is a kick-ass song, like, it is, and Zeppelin kicks ass. I'm not even a big Led Zeppelin fan, but like everyone should know they kick ass.
Yeah.
Just because they didn't write that song does not mean it's not badass when they play it. Like they're some cool dudes who play some cool music. They didn't write every cool song ever. And that, I didn't want to sort of walk down that path in the commentary I was making, but there really is a difference between a musician and an artist. And those two things don't necessarily make you a songwriter. And you don't have to be a songwriter to be either of those things. You know, it's true in reverse. But it's often amalgamated in people's minds. Like, oh, you're the guitar player, so like you must write the guitar parts. And like, if your songs have good guitar in them, it's your doing. Well, I mean, Dragon Force might be shredding at guitar, but like, you know, who cares? Like, are they the most influential guitar players of the whatever century? No. It's probably somebody you've never heard of, somebody who's not in a band, someone who doesn't play live music.
It's probably Steve Lukather, like the the Toto guitar player.
Well, I wasn't going to get into a game of favorites. I have my own favorite guitar players, but another day.
I'm not talking about favorites. I'm talking about influential like guitar players, like people behind the scenes of stuff that people don't know about. You know, like, for example, Steve Lukather is actually the guy that wrote the riff to Beat It. And yeah, and people don't know this. And he played it. So
that's pretty interesting.
Yeah. And he's, by the way, he's the guitarist for Toto, which is like everybody knows Hold the Line in Africa. And those are probably the only songs that, like, not that they're not great musicians, but those are probably the best songs that they had, you know, that they've written together, you know, as musicians. But again,
certainly the most popular. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
well, Simon Phillips is a badass at drums.
Yeah.
I mean, like, people should know who Toto is, but like,
yeah,
they're definitely not relevant to like modern pop music. You know, if you're 12 or 15 or 16 or whatever right now, chances are you're not really into Toto.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I was just making the comment because, you know, he's a guitar player with a lot of influences. And in fact, like, you know, at the time there was I've told this story a little while ago, but apparently on Sunset Boulevard, I think it was at the Whiskey A Go-Go. So pretty big place in LA. Van Halen was playing and Steve Lukather was in the audience that night. And, you know, there was this whole discussion amongst musicians about Steve Lukather and Eddie Van Halen and which one was actually just a better guitar player. And so Eddie, being the cocky, you know, kind of, you know what that he is. He calls Steve out and Steve's like, all right. So he walks up on stage and like Alex, Eddie's brother, starts playing drums.
Yep.
And he gives Steve like the first, you know, the first go. He gets to be on the play. And and Steve starts whipping out like hip hop influence stuff and like bossa nova fusion jazz, you know, just anything that he could do that wasn't rock and roll. And Eddie like couldn't do a damn thing. Like he made him look like a complete fool. It's one of my favorite stories because, you know, it encourages musicians and people to be well-rounded. And I think that Steve Lukather was like a really good example. He's one of the most underrated guitar players, I think.
Well, I think if we've learned anything from this segment, it is do your homework, boys and girls.
Yeah. So question I have for you, speaking of homework, is moving the topic of books. I read recently that you've read about 15 books this year. I wanted to know which ones you like the most, if there are bad ones, and did, like, you know, just a general understanding of the things that Eric reads.
Okay. To begin, you need the context of the fact that I really don't like to read books. And I got college reading about 4 books.
Well done.
I think, you know, textbooks included, novels, pleasure reading, like everything. I just don't read novels. But my New Year's resolution this year was to commit very heavily to doing that. You know,
good resolution.
I was gonna read a book a month, just A, to prove to myself that I can do something I don't like and profit by it, and secondarily to get better informed. You know, there's a lot of good information in books. I don't know if you've ever heard, but reading leads to being better informed.
Yeah.
But thirdly, is like because there's such great stuff out there that I haven't had access to because I just generally write off reading. I knew that there's going to be a lot of stuff that I really could get into, and it was just up to me to go out there and find it. So I committed, and I've actually been really enjoying it. I've actually finished 16,
okay,
and I'm cool partway through 2 different books right now. So I'll probably be up to 20 by the end of October, at least, you know, if not by the end of September.
Impressive.
So I'm keeping a list of them because measuring your, you know, set goals,
definitely,
measure your results. That's what I'm all about. Data, data, data. So I've got the list. The first was Everything is Bullshit by Priceonomics, which is a blog about big data. Go figure.
Okay.
Everything is Bullshit is very funny, very interesting, very thought-provoking. It is about a lot of commonly held myths in modern American society, and a lot of things that you think are true that really have sources you've never heard about. So I really got
one example.
One example.
Yeah.
I'm drinking wine right now.
Yeah.
There's a chapter in the book all about wine, and the pricing of wine is based very much on prestige.
Right.
Normal people do not have the ability to tell the difference in taste or quality of even incredibly expensive rare wines with total garbage that you can buy at the grocery store for $6. It's indistinguishable to the normal humans. And if you look at the data that they present in the book, master sommeliers basically are 50-50. You know, sometimes they can figure it out, sometimes they can't. So in the mind of the authors, wine is bullshit. And like, if there's no way even masters who've trained for decades can consistently figure out what's good wine and what's not, then maybe there's not really any rhyme or reason to it. It's just, you know, to play the old quote, there's no accounting for taste. You know, it's just what people think is cool. There is, however, a documented phenomenon that if you know that the wine you're drinking is expensive, you actually enjoy it more measurably. You know, this was a study where they hooked people up to electro sensors in their brain to like measure their happiness levels.
Yeah.
You know, they're taking chemical and electrical measurements to see the physical signs of happiness. So that was interesting. Yeah. So that was the first book that I read. And go ahead.
Quick comment on that. I call that the shitty movie / shitty game experience. Like, for example, if you spend $50 on a game or you spend, $20 on a movie and you end up not liking it, you still like it more than a movie that you didn't like that you didn't pay for. Like, because you actually had to spend resources on it.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
The real name for this is sunk cost fallacy, but
okay,
it's extrapolating out of psychology and now into, you know, the actual demonstrable effects of cost and effect in your personal economy. You have a vested interest. You're biased to some degree that the things you've invested resources in have to work out because your resources are limited, and your brain will play that trick on you quite a bit. You really have to watch out for that and not think that every John Cusack punch is good.
Yeah, really, for sure. I mean, you know, and it's not even, a lot of times, if it's good, it's not even about John Cusack.
Yeah. So, but I do agree with you, though. I really, when I watch a movie for free that is bad, I feel like a total idiot. Often I won't even make it all the way through.
Yeah. 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 So, so moving along on the list of books.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say I got lucky that Everything Was Bullshit was right up my alley. It's the kind of book that I can get into. It's the kind of information I want to read about. Mm-hmm. And it was presented in a very easily digestible format. And I happened to be reading it on Kindle.
Oh, cool.
So, I could take it anywhere and not have the physical paper book in my hand, which is something I've always hated about reading.
Yeah.
The paper pages, it grinds on me. I can't do it. But I was getting into the 21st century, and turns out I like reading now more than I ever could have as a child because I don't have actual paper books.
Cool.
But that set me off on a good, first foot, and I was able to tear through, the rest of these books at a pretty reasonable pace just based on the success that early success that I'd had.
Yeah.
But to run down the list and give you some thumbs up, thumbs down about them, mm-hmm. The second was Things to Make and Do in the Fourth Dimension, which is a book about fun applications of complex mathematics, which is not for the faint of heart. You really have to either have been a math or engineering student in college to even get what we're talking about in this book. But I liked it. It had a lot of cool, like, party trick kind of math, which, if you care, you get into. The third book I read was The Checklist Manifesto, who some people will swear by this book. And I'm one of the people. I used to call them in college Libralists. Mm-hmm. Like, if I have things I need to get done in a day or a week, I just make a to-do list. It's so easy. You can't forget something if it's on the list. And The Checklist Manifesto spends a lot of time looking at real-world examples of industries where there are real consequences that, like doctors, for example, so many malpractice suits and so many patients are affected because people forget things. Well, the checklist doesn't forget. So if you can save 7 lives per year in your hospital and eliminate 2 lawsuits just by printing out one checklist for every patient, and it costs you a couple $1,000s a year in paper, just do it. Like, checklists are like the magical, they're the magic wand of getting stuff done correctly.
Sweet.
It's incredible.
My brother recently, he just finished school for web design and digital media. He's actually one of the guys that's going to be helping me with our project of revamping the site. And he's just recently been able to get some free time so that he can help us get that done. But one of the things that he actually developed while he was in school and he published it is it's available for download. I'll put the link in the show notes as well as a link to this list of Eric's books to read. You can put thumbs up, thumbs down, whatever you want to do next.
Some
to
of them I endorse, some of them I don't.
Yeah. So, but anyway, this thing, my brother actually developed a checklist application, something that can go for grocery stores and things like that. So I'll try to find that link for you and put it in the show notes. He's being hosted on some really obscure site that's not like a major outlet, but it's out there. And like any chance to hype up things that that he's done that are pretty sweet, and eventually, hopefully, you guys will soon see what he's going to be doing with the new site because it's going to be pretty cool. So
yeah, just so you guys know, the CommanderCast group, we're a wholly nepotistic business. If you're not our friend and or relative, you just can't participate. I'm sorry. Yep. We only plug our people here.
Yeah. Yo-Yo Ma's cousin, little nepotist. All right. So
moving on. Mm-hmm. After this, I was a little bit behind actually because of some stuff that had happened in my personal and work life that I didn't want to let this affect my long-term goal. So I had to look for a new format and I started listening to audiobooks, a lot of which are available free on YouTube. So that's this next section. I just blew through, six or eight books in one or like maybe 6 weeks, just by being able to listen to them in the car on the way to work and stuff like that. So the next one I read was Dear God, which is, by Penn Jillette of Penn and Teller fame, who, I'm a big fan of his work in magic and television, magic, the performing art, not the gathering.
Right.
Yeah. But he's hilarious. And it's sort of like a collection of biographical stories and also his atheist ramblings, which, he's an opinionated man. He's kind of on a crusade sometimes about things. So you can agree or disagree, but it's an interesting read either way. The next book I read is The 4-Hour Work Week, which I've been raving about to everyone that I see because this book is, if you want to be productive, like if you want to improve the trajectory of your life so that you can actually achieve your goals and become somebody that you're going to be proud of later on, you need to not just read, study this book, like tear out the pages, photocopy them, post them around your house so you stay on track and can get the results out of your life that you really want. And he has strategies about how to improve many aspects of your life, not just your professional career. It's sort of told from this perspective of how you're going to get rich quick almost, mm-hmm. but it's like the get rich quick and intelligent way, but also stay rich forever and do things that are productive. So it's much more rigorous than the typical self-help nonsense.
I would recommend not like digesting this, like tearing pages out and digesting it Red Dragon style. That will not work with the 4-hour work week.
Yeah, don't literally do that.
But if
this
you,
is
you
know, a figurative discussion.
Yeah, just like take notes, highlight pages, put little little bookends on things that you like, little notes. This is one of those books that you need to be academic with.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he will teach you to be a good student of your own methods and to improve your methods, and that's really the only skill that you need. If you can consistently improve the things that you do and the way that you do them, it will have a transformative effect on your life. And it has for me, absolutely. I'm in a much better spot in essentially every area of my life than I was a year ago. And the last 6 months of that is due in large part to the focus that this book has instilled in me and the strategies it's given me to evaluate my own methods. So I highly recommend it.
Cool.
Moving right along, The Art of War by Sun Tzu, mm-hmm. which I have was actually one of the books that I did read in college, but I read again because after reading The 4-Hour Work Week, I needed another, I was just on like a life strategy kick. And there's a lot of, really golden advice for people like me in The Art of War that, you need to cut out distractions and be efficient and be ruthless with yourself and others. Like if you have a goal, you need to chase it voraciously and don't accept substitutes. Don't accept second best. Like in his book, it's about defending your country in war and like winning battles. So the stakes were very high. So he was not willing to accept lower quality substitutes in terms of his strategy. And I think that's definitely something I apply to magic.
Yeah, definitely. Now, did you listen to it in audiobook form?
Yeah. So actually, I was listening to the LibriVox recording, which I do want to plug because they're a series of public domain recordings that's totally free and available on YouTube. And there's hundreds of books of historical significance that you can listen to.
So who narrated this? Was it anybody famous or anything?
The Art of War? I do not know who narrated
it. I feel like that's a book that would really want to be narrated. You want to listen to it by somebody that has like a really compelling voice.
I'm sure that you can find some really awesome audiobook versions.
Yeah.
LibriVox is it's a nonprofit project just to make audio recordings available to people. Fair. So it's completely
Different.
Like open. Yeah, like you can contribute if you want. Like you can be part of the project. You just pick a book you like, record yourself speaking it, and upload it to their, you know, their organization, and they'll publish it for you. It's, you know, it's meant to be like a charitable thing almost, so that people who don't have access to physical books in their libraries but have a stable enough internet connection can listen to these or download them.
Sweet.
Okay. Yeah. The next was The Pig That Wants to Be Eaten by Julian Beghini, and it's told in a collection of 100 thought experiments about a variety of topics, but mostly ethics, which is fascinating to me because I'm a big, you know, armchair philosopher. So if you're into philosophizing with your friends and having intellectual discussions, this book will give you some great material for that.
Haven't heard of that one.
Yeah, The Pig That Wants to Be, it's got some pretty interesting stuff in it. Lots of examples are borrowed from sci-fi, because sci-fi of the 70s and 80s was so good at posing questions like, well, you know, if you do this, let's say you could advance technology such that it puts yourself into an ethical dilemma. What do you do in this situation? You know, things like time machines and cloning and just, you know, the social implications of increasing the pace of technology.
Yeah.
There's a lot of questions like that contained in this book that would be interesting to sci-fi fans.
Sweet.
The eighth book that I finished was Rich Dad, Poor Dad, a very famous self-help personal finance book. Not too much to say about it. If you haven't read it, it's very short, very easy to read, and it has great advice. You know, if you're struggling with money, read it. If you are wealthy, you probably already know. You know, it's very simple stuff. Mm-hmm. The next was Letter to a Christian Nation by Sam Harris, who's another famous and crusading atheist. And this was this is a much more direct attack on Christianity than Penn Jillette's book was. But again, like, it was short and it was in audiobook form, so it was very easy for me to get access to and complete in a reasonable time frame. Would not necessarily recommend. You know,
question.
Some people find it. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask, have any of these books so far that you've read mentioned any of the things that you posted, I think, a little while ago to one of our other friends about the whole Roman construction of Jesus in the Bible?
Yeah, actually, that book, I can't remember the name. To bring everybody in, I can't remember the gentleman's name or the name of his book. It's sort of a little bit of what some people think of as like a crackpot historian who has a theory and what he claims is supporting evidence that Jesus was a hoax invented by the Roman government to quell uprising in Judea. At that time, the Hebrews were in open revolt and it was violent, and Romans were drawn in several directions. They weren't able to commit adequate resources to use their army to put down the revolt. So instead, the frumentarii, which were the agents of Caesar, like basically the CIA of the Roman government, used counterintelligence strategy to sort of like use agents provocateur to instill a religious coup. And this new Christianity was a much, you know, turn the other cheek. Like that was the tagline of Jesus. Like, be accepting, be compliant, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, but then render unto God what is God's. So like they had a much less violent take on the situation, and by converting people to Christianity rather than the more violent branch of Judaism that was popular at the time, they were able to effectively quell the level of rebellion in the area. That theory is nearly unsubstantiated. And again, this is totally off topic.
Right.
But I have not read that gentleman's entire book. It's on my list of things to do, and I will get it done this year. But that's about all I can tell you for now.
Okay.
That's like the top level tip of the iceberg of his theory.
Okay. I didn't know if any of these other guys had mentioned it, or if they were just like, nope, you know, like, you know, there's a lot of atheist literature that's, you know, pretty much like the Sam Harris thing you were just talking about.
Yeah. Most atheists do not agree with him.
Yeah.
In fact, most people in general don't agree with him because, from what I understand, he has pretty liberal interpretations of some historical documents, maybe take some liberties with historical documents that are not necessarily correct or right to take. But again, I haven't read the entire text, so I'll maintain no position until I actually read it for myself.
Cool.
Number 10 was the U.S. Army's Simple Sabotage Field Manual, which I know is like a very, like, why would you read this? Like, it's a military training handbook for people who are caught in enemy territory, like in occupied enemy territory, and things that you can do in relative secret to hamper military operations of the enemy occupiers, without getting yourself implicated, which it, like, you want to talk about strategy. Like, this has some golden gems. It's a very strange book, but if you want to learn, like, just some ways that you can sabotage your employer or your workplace, you know, without getting blamed, this is the book for you. It's like everything that happens at the end of Office Space, like, is inspired by this book.
Oh wow!
So, yeah, it's very fun. I mean, it's not meant to be funny. It's a very dry, like, training manual, but you can see the humor in applying some of these lessons to your daily life for, you know, just pure prankability.
That sounds awesome.
So I don't think anyone out there is going to read this, but it's available free on YouTube. I would thumbs up it. I've had a great time listening to it. The next one was called Hipster Business Models. The first book I talked about, Everything is Bullshit, the blog that published it, Pricenomics, wrote a second book called Hipster Business Models, which is told through 20 stories of startup companies whose business models really could not have existed before the 21st century. And it details how, you know, some examples of the stories are like how food trucks went from being the dirtiest, like, most downtrodden food for people who were not very wealthy, to suddenly it's an explosion. It's like a cultural icon, and gentrified areas suddenly have, like, food truck rallies, and young people are all over it. They have some relatively new, like, internet-based companies. There's breweries. There's some talk about different types of nonprofit organizations. So it basically just is a discussion of different types of businesses that are becoming popular or just now possible in the 21st century, which I think is pretty interesting. It was not as good. It's probably the worst book, actually, that I've mentioned so far in terms of writing, but it has some fun stories in there, if you like stories.
Did they talk about the snuggle business? The business where, you know, you basically have a bed in a room and a desk, and then you snuggle per hour?
Yeah, they did not talk about this,
okay.
But
it's the most ridiculous. It's deplorable, in my opinion.
Yeah, I've heard about that, and it is an interesting concept to me. It's actually big in Japan, okay. To borrow a phrase, but
I mean, I would not be, I'm not surprised, but
yeah,
I mean,
a lot of things, like, are big in Japan.
Like, and the fact that, here's the thing, like, this is part of the reasons that I'm terrified of going to Portland. This is reason number one, actually, is the fact that they have these kinds of, like, really weird businesses that I don't think are interesting at all. Like, I feel like I'd just be like, oh, that's a business where people get paid to cuddle. Like, this is terrible. I want to go home. Like, I'm, like, turned off by this idea already in my head. And, like, I know that that's, like, a wrong, you know, it's not nice. It's not a fair thing to think, but it's just the way I feel.
Yeah. If you're judgy about hipsters, and personally, I am a little judgy about hipsters.
Me too.
So that will influence your interpretation of hipster business models as a book.
Okay.
If you think that the things these people are doing are bullshit, you will look at the results of their business as though that they are bullshit. Like, how should these people get to do whatever? You know, why does Uber get to break the rules? Or why is beer suddenly popular? Like, you know, if you're judgmental about their general culture, you're not going to appreciate an in-depth discussion of their business. It's going to be very boring.
Well, I like the idea of Uber personally. Like, that seems fine. Like, this is an interesting topic, hipster businesses, because I do like Uber. I think Uber is a reasonable business, and I think it makes sense. Where I draw the line is, like, ridiculousness. I mean, cuddling, you know, I feel like I just don't get it. I don't understand. But that's fine. I also draw the line at certain hipsterdoms. Like, for example, just a brief anecdote about my brother and the guy who's designing our website. He did not want to buy, or he did not get an apartment recently with a washer/dryer. And so in order to combat this situation, he purchased this thing on Amazon that is basically a blow dryer, but with, like, some kind of controlled area so that he can hang up his clothes in it and it will dry them. And he called my mom and me to ask if we had a bicycle still at the house, because he was going to use the bicycle setup to create some kind of machine washer.
That is going pretty deep.
Yeah, and just to save money. And I was like, well, how much money would it be to cost? You know, it's like, essentially you're buying at least a washer for a washer dryer combo. It was just totally weird. And I draw the line here. I do not see the economic value in it, but hey, some people like being environmentally conscious. Some people like these things. I'm not one of them. I don't think that Eric is one of them either.
The interesting takeaway for me that I got from this book is that our generation gets a lot of flack for not necessarily entering the workforce and contributing the same way that previous generations did. But at the same time, if you look at it differently, our generation is very much one of entrepreneurs. We are the generation of small business owner. People will sell pillows on Etsy. People, you know, make homemade soap. People are brewing their own beer. Like, we are the do-it-yourselfers of Americans. We don't want to be middle-income Americans working in, like, some weird semi-management, semi-customer service job. That doesn't appeal to us anymore. Like, we know what we're interested in. We're educated enough that we can decide how and when to act in the economy. And people have chosen to make careers for themselves where previously nothing existed. And I think that if you're down on millennials, maybe you can learn something positive by reading this book, that, you know, there's a way that everyone can contribute. And really, that is your number one job as a citizen of our economy, is like, just find your niche, man. Get your hammer and chisel it out and be there and do what you love and make a reasonable living doing it. Maybe you're not going to blow up and be a Fortune 100 company. But if you like, you know, playing Magic, you can probably make a career playing Magic if you work hard enough at it and you market yourself right.
So moving down the list, hipster business models, then
we're in the home stretch now.
Okay.
The Dhammapada, which is the sayings of the Buddha.
Okay.
Not much to say there. He has some great stuff to say. Mm-hmm. I'm not a Buddhist. I'm not particularly religious in any kind of way, but I think there's a lot that you can learn about keeping yourself mindful from Buddhism. So some interesting stuff in there. The next two are like a combo. Common Sense by Thomas Paine.
Okay, perfect.
The American revolutionary and, you know, writer about economics who's famously against taxes, famously against federalist government and against monarchies.
Yeah.
I read that and then followed it up with The Communist Manifesto by Karl Marx, who is obviously probably the world's most famous communist. Well, maybe behind Fidel Castro, but you know, anyway. but that was a very interesting juxtaposition. And the way these two books are written was actually really interesting, that I was on board with like everything they said in these books up until like the last quarter. And then, interestingly, both of them sort of went off the rails. You know, like, I was with you, Thomas Paine, until, like, you started going off of, like, okay, well, you're just going to start shooting your neighbor because they're sympathizers. Well, you know what? Maybe that's not the correct approach. Like, that's where we would have dropped off. I agree that Charles is kind of a tard, and I don't like taxes either, and people should have the right to decide themselves about whatever issue, but don't maybe shoot your neighbor. And then in the Communist Manifesto, obviously, he's talking about the proletariat and seizing power in the bourgeois, and he does the same thing. He's like, you know, this is so great. We're going to have a revolution. We're going to have a true, meaningful improvement in the rights and abilities of workers. And you know what? We're going to do this by storming the bourgeoisie's house and taking their stuff and killing them. And I mean, these were men who lived in a different time. Absolutely. But like they had aggressive sensibilities and they shared that, like, the on economics, they were on different sides of the coin.
Yeah.
But in terms of their revolutionary status and their fervor as men and as writers and as leaders, they were very much the same person. And it's strange that I was reading these two books back to back and able to draw those sort of similarities. You can see these men's personality shine through in the passion of their writing. And they were really just two sides of the same coin of, you know, weird economic disputes and who was being oppressed at what times in history. They could very easily have been standing side by side had they been born in the same era. You know,
it's very that's fascinating.
Yeah, it's kind of strange. It's eerie almost, the how things line up.
Well,
and the two books are pretty similar in length as well. So
what's the solution to people that don't like my opinion? Murder.
Yeah.
Like,
I guess.
Wow.
Well, you know, in their case, it's hard to argue that they weren't right. I'm not a communist, but if you feel like you're being oppressed and you stand up for it and people don't take you seriously, you are left with two choices: either accept their oppression or escalate the conflict. You know, it can really only go two ways. And in those moments in history, they just had to keep escalating until the people in power were like, okay, well, we're gonna attack you. We're gonna use our superior British Navy or, you know, our Russian military. Like, you know what? They had the ideology of the people. They'd captured the hearts and minds of people, and maybe they didn't have all the guns, but what are you going to do? Like, who's going to pay taxes to you if you shoot all of us? They had that magical dollar on their side. You know, like, Charles, for example, in England, King Charles just wasn't interested, and King George as well, just wasn't interested in wholesale murder of colonial citizens, because a major driver of revenue was taxes, excise taxes in the colonies. Well, if in a civil war, no one wins economically. You're destroying your own country's property. You're killing your own country's citizens. It's just impossible for you to profit. So a violent solution to this conflict is the last thing that you'd want as a civil governor of an economic state. That, you know, it's sad that in previous points in history, that's really the only way conflict was ever resolved.
Yeah.
We still see it happening today in a lot of parts of the world.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's an interesting concept for sure. I don't have any conclusive thoughts about what is right or wrong about what these men did, but they were fascinating personalities. Yeah. So the next is 4-Hour Body. 4-Hour Work Week is written by Tim Ferriss. He has written two other books, The 4-Hour Body and 4-Hour Chef. 4-Hour Body is applying his same principles of, you know, taking measurements, setting goals, using his life philosophy about how to be more efficient to personal fitness instead of improving your finances and career. And that's the diet that got me drinking wine instead of beer. And the last book was The Enchiridion of Epictetus, who is a Roman philosopher. And he was a advisor to Nero, one of the more famous emperors of Rome. For those of you who don't know, I took many, many years of Latin in high school, and I'm a major fan of and student of the classics. And I love poetry. I love, you know, Cicero's letters, Ovid, Virgil. I'm all over it. So anything Roman or anything philosophy, I'm cool with. And he happens to match up with both of those.
Sweet.
So I finished that. And one of the books I'm going through right now is actually a collection of 6 Stoic philosophers, one of which, you know, one of the authors in there is Epictetus as well. So I'm enjoying it. It's definitely not for everyone. So I guess like net thumbs down because it's dry and it's written as though it were translated from Latin because it was.
Yeah.
But I'm a big fan. I'm nerding out about it. And what
sounds,
can I say?
It sounds sweet. It sounds sweet. You've got quite a collection. I have not. I cannot beat your collection. I have only a couple of books I've read this year. And I just really haven't been. I haven't been able to keep focused. I've had a lot of stuff, other stuff going on, and just trying to move and. Make an excuse for myself.
That's the best thing about it. Like having A, followed through on my own New Year's resolution,
right,
and B, read a bunch of books, I can just rub this in the face of everybody because those are two things that people usually don't get by with. You know, everybody fails their New Year's resolutions. That's sort of the trope. And no one reads enough. Like, can you really read enough? Can you be well enough informed? It's like such a thing just doesn't exist to me.
Well, not only that, but like, you know, if I was to read even the equivalent of 16 books, like physically, you know, physical copies of books, they would not stack up to the amount of actual tangible knowledge that you've accumulated over the last 8 months or 9 months or whatever.
Yeah. Well, you know, this goes back to the idea of me not liking science fiction, and I don't really like fiction in general.
Yeah.
So you can see that none of, I guess you can, if you don't believe in Buddha or like the power of the Buddha, you may not think that the Dhammapada is real. You could consider that a fiction book. You might not think that Karl Marx was a sane individual. So you might think the Communist Manifesto is fiction. But beyond that.
Penn Jillette. He might not be real to you either.
Potentially.
So, I mean, I think the one book I read this year, I actually took, there's a lot of great bookstores here in Seattle, and I've actually been through several of them just trying to find stuff that I'm even interested in reading. Because I do want to, you know, do things, but I haven't found things that I want to read in quite the way that you have. And, you know, one book that I ended up reading was Kurt Vonnegut, and it was Breakfast of Champions, and that book is wonderful. It's everything that you want in a story. It's completely satisfying in just about every way. Alrighty, well, we're going to go ahead and close it up for this episode of The Stack. Do you have any final thoughts, Chris?
I do not.
Alright, so if you guys want to reach us, we're going to put our contact stuff in the show notes. We have a bunch of stuff also in the show notes, as always, for you guys to peruse and check out. And thanks for listening.